For the benefit of the translators, I'll try to break out of customary pattern and keep pretty much to a prepared text. Our thoughts are naturally focused on the present moment and on what may lie ahead, but we can easily mislead ourselves if we do not attend carefully to long-standing continuities and their roots in institutions that have been stable for a long time. So I hope you'll bear with me if I go back into history a little bit, not out of just an interest in history, but because I think that what we discover is that if by understanding it enables us to overcome illusions about the present and the future. The inter-American system, of which the OAS is a part, goes back to the early 19th century. In varying ways, the system has always been dominated by the enormous disparity between the one and the rest. For the United States, the first and most fundamental of our foreign policies is the Monroe Doctrine, quoting Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, as Washington prepared to overthrow the government of Guatemala in 1954, with consequences that we need not review. What is the Monroe Doctrine? Well, its meaning was explained by President Woodrow Wilson and his Secretary of State. They agreed, quoting, that in its advocacy of the Monroe Doctrine, the United States considers its own interests. The integrity of other American nations is an incident, not an end. While this may seem based on selfishness alone, the author of the doctrine had no higher or more generous motive in its declaration. Although it would be impolitic to state these facts openly, the president advised. So this is for internal discussion, not for public presentation. History demonstrates very well the accuracy of this perception, and it is understood well enough. So one enduring theme of the inter-American system has been the effort to make non-intervention the cornerstone of the system, and the system itself an instrument of restraint upon its powerful neighbor. I'm quoting the major scholarly history. Intervention includes economic coercion, that's stressed in the Charter of the Organization of American States, and by many observers, who warn that a people economically enslaved but politically free will end by losing all freedom. It's an observation of José Martí's that extends to the rich societies as well. Well, what about the powerful neighbor? The powerful neighbor has been guided by a different principle, one that was articulated by the distinguished statesman Dean Acheson in justifying the embargo against Cuba in 1963. He informed the Association for International Law that the propriety of a response to a challenge to the power, position, and prestige of the United States is not a legal issue. Although, he said, international law is sometimes useful to gild our positions with an ethos derived from very general moral principles. Updating traditional doctrine, President Clinton informed in 1993 that the United States will act multilaterally when possible, but unilaterally when necessary. That position was reiterated by Ambassador Madeleine Albright and a year later, and in 1999 by Secretary of Defense William Cohen. He declared that the United States is committed to unilateral use of military power to defend vital interests, which include ensuring uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources. Earlier, the State Department had explained Washington's rejection of world court jurisdiction on the grounds that, I'm quoting again, most of the world cannot be counted on to share our view, and the majority often opposes the United States on important international questions. Hence, we must reserve to ourselves the power to determine how we will act, and which matters fall essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States as determined by the United States. In this case, these were the actions that the court condemned as the unlawful use of force against Nicaragua. On the side, I would say that in any country that valued its freedom, the United States or Canada, all of these things would be taught in elementary school. These are the sort of core truisms of international affairs. These truisms, and again, that's what they are regularly illustrated in practice, and they're also clearly articulated, particularly in the internal record, and they're understood. We witnessed that just a few weeks ago when the political leaders of the South, roughly 80% of the population of the world, met first in Colombia, then in Havana, and issued a declaration, the Declaration of the South Summit. The declaration condemned the form of globalization that's been instituted by the West, designed to serve the needs of concentrated private power, with the needs of others considered an incident, not an end in Wilsonian terms. The declaration called for a new global order in which the highest priority will be the right to independent development, incidentally a right that the United States officially rejects in strong terms, and a right that is virtually barred by the rules of the World Trade Organization, which systematically banned the devices that were used by England, the United States, and other rich countries to win their place in the sun. And it also imposes a highly protectionist set of rules, including a patent regime, which again the rich countries never accepted while they were developing, which is designed to ensure huge profits and control of the technology of the future for the corporate entities that rely on state power. The South Summit rejects this form of globalization forcefully and insists on, I'm quoting it, insists on the right of developing countries to choose the path of development in accordance with their national priorities and objectives and to determine their own fiscal policies without any interference in their internal affairs. That's echoing the OAS Charter. The summit also firmly rejects all forms of coercive economic measures, including unilateral sanctions. Actually, about half the population of the world right now is subject to unilateral U.S. sanctions. In one case, Cuba, so severe as to bar even food and medicine. These sanctions have been declared illegal by just about every appropriate body, including the OAS, but irrelevantly on the Atchisonian principle. The summit also rejected, quoting, the so-called right of humanitarian intervention, which much of the world regards as a new guise for Western imperialism under the familiar cloak of righteous moralism. Well, these positions are conventional, as is the fact that they are unheard. So the declaration of the countries that account for 80% of the world's population received no mention at all in the United States press. Also removed from the public eye are the motives for the persistent military and economic coercion, which goes back a long time. The motives precede the Cold War, and they hold with little change after it ended. In the interim, the Cold War provided a convenient pretext, but it was rarely a leading element. The internal record makes that very clear, case by case, and it's worth understanding. So take, for example, the case of Cuba. The Cuban threat was explained in secret, but it's been declassified for some years. The Cuban threat was outlined by historian Arthur Schlesinger. He was reporting the conclusions of John F. Kennedy's Latin American mission to the incoming president back in 1961. The Cuban threat, he said, is the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into one's own hands, which might stimulate the poor and underprivileged elsewhere in Latin America who are now demanding opportunities for a decent living. There's a name for that. It's called the virus effect, the virus that might infect others, or the rotten apple effect, the rotten apple that might spoil the barrel. There was a Cold War connection, and here it is, total, in toto. The Soviet Union hovers in the wings, flourishing large development loans and presenting itself as the model for achieving modernization in a single generation. So that's the Soviet threat. If you look at the overthrow of Guatemalan democracy, it was similarly motivated. For the public, it was the Russians are coming. Internally, U.S. intelligence warned, quoting, these are all quotes, that the social and economic programs of the elected government met the aspirations of labor and the peasantry and inspired the loyalty and conformed to the self-interest of most politically conscious Guatemalans. The government was preparing to mobilize the hitherto inert peasantry, introducing unwelcome forms of democracy. Still worse, Guatemala was becoming a virus. Its agrarian reform is a powerful propaganda weapon. Its broad social program of aiding the workers and the peasants in a victorious struggle against the upper classes and large foreign enterprises has a strong appeal to the populations of Central American neighbors where similar conditions prevail. The result, you know, it was an end to the years of spring in the country of eternal tyranny, in the words of a Guatemalan poet, or in the words of the Eisenhower administration, it was the addition of a new and glorious chapter to the already great tradition of the American states. You can take your choice. Similar concerns are illustrated throughout the internal documentary record, in fact, all over the world, including Southeast Asia and elsewhere. They constitute the rational core of what's called the domino theory, and the reason why the domino theory consistently guides policy very rationally. Different imagery is preferred for public consumption, but that's the guiding thinking, and it makes sense in an ugly way. The same principles guide attitudes toward democracy. The issues are very well explained in one of the leading scholarly studies of the current version of democratization. It's by Thomas Carruthers, a Latin American scholar, who writes with what he calls an insider's perspective, since he took part in the democracy enhancement programs in Reagan's State Department. He thinks that these programs were sincere, but he describes them as a failure because, I'm quoting, because Washington sought to maintain the basic order of quite undemocratic societies and to avoid populist-based change. Inevitably seeking only limited top-down forms of democratic change that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied. Which is correct. That's what democracy is supposed to mean. And case after case illustrates that. So to take a post-Cold War example, take, say, Haiti, poorest country in the hemisphere, and the one that has had the benefit of the longest tutelage by the United States. The case of Haiti is another illustration of continuity of policy from before the Cold War to the present with very little change. Haiti was invaded and occupied by Woodrow Wilson before the Russian Revolution. That was in defense against the Huns. The Russian hadn't arrived yet. That left a bitter legacy. In the 1980s, Haiti was turned into an experimental subject for neoliberal programs that were going to turn it into the Taiwan of the Pacific, USAID announced. Didn't state Haiti, not Taiwan. The program sent the country deeper into ruin, for example, virtually wiping out rice production by requiring unrestricted import of subsidized U.S. rice, which in fact was granted even higher public subsidies under the radically anti-market doctrines of the Reagan administration. Somehow, in a truly inspiring achievement, Haitians carried out an amazing democratic election. They elected their first democratic government in 1990, and people who want to learn something about what democracy really is should look at that election. It was quite a lesson for the rest of the continent, including North America. The election upset the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied, in Carruthers' words, and that's a violation of the rules of the game. Washington moved instantly to undermine and destroy the government. A few months later, it was removed by a military coup. The OAS declared an embargo, but that was undermined at once by the U.S. government by exempting U.S. firms. President Bush and Clinton went even further, Clinton particularly. They even authorized illegal shipments of oil to the military junta and its wealthy supporters. So in effect, there was an embargo, but only directed against the poor, not against the wealthy and the military government. After the population was subjected to 3 years of terror, the United States agreed to, as they put it, restore democracy, but on condition that the government accept the harsh neoliberal programs of the U.S. candidate in the 1990 election, who had received 14% of the vote. So we have democracy. The country now continues on its downward spiral, thanks in no small measure to its treatment by the powerful neighbor through the past century. From the early 1990s, the worst human rights violator in the hemisphere by far has been Colombia. It's also been the leading recipient of U.S. arms and military training. That correlation, incidentally, is very well established from way back. In 1999, Colombia became the world's leading recipient of U.S. arms, displacing Turkey. There are two others, Israel and Egypt, but they're in a separate category. Turkey, and the transition is an interesting one. It explains a lot about what's going on. Turkey had received a huge flow of U.S. arms since 1984. That peaked in 1997. The arms flow in 1997 alone exceeded the entire period prior to 1984. Well, what's going on? There was no Cold War connection. Rather, in 1984, Turkey launched a vicious campaign of ethnic cleansing and atrocities against its miserably oppressed Kurdish population. The worst atrocities were under Clinton, and they were quite extreme. Clinton provided 80% of Turkey's arms. However, by 1999, the terror had largely succeeded, so the arms flow could reduce. But Colombia had not yet suppressed its internal insurgencies. These are rooted in socioeconomic conditions that are shameful even by Latin American standards, which is saying a lot. State terror became much worse under the initiatives of the Kennedy administration, which provided arms and military training for internal repression throughout the hemisphere. There was a mission to Colombia headed by a special forces general. That mission, Kennedy mission, recommended that the security forces, as necessary, execute paramilitary, sabotage, and or terrorist activities against known communist proponents. That's a phrase which has very broad coverage. In the 1990s, the annual toll of atrocities has been about 3,000 killed and 300,000 refugees. The overwhelming majority are attributed to the military and its paramilitary associates. The close linkage between them has been documented once again in the past few months by a long report of Human Rights Watch and a United Nations report. In 1999, atrocities increased sharply, almost 80% of them attributed to the paramilitary-military alliance. And again, conforming to traditional patterns, a U.S. arms flow increased, in fact tripled, in 1999, and it's now scheduled to rise even more sharply under the pretext of a drug war, the Russians not being around as a pretext. Well, the pretext can't be taken seriously, but the problems of drug use are indeed serious. The most severe of these, by a large factor, involves tobacco use. That's the worst public health problem in the United States. The Supreme Court recently, in fact, declared it the worst public health hazard in the United States. It causes about 25 times as many deaths as all illegal drugs combined. Now, tobacco use has been declining in the United States, and producers have therefore turned to exports. There's a five-fold increase from 1975 to 1995. Notice that other countries must accept U.S.-produced lethal substances on pain of trade sanctions, and they must even accept advertising directed to vulnerable populations, or else they get hit by Super 301. The Colombian cartels, in contrast, are not permitted to run advertising campaigns extolling the wonders of cocaine. Quote two leading public health researchers, they write that the effects of aggressive marketing and advertising by American firms is in good measure responsible for a sizable increase in smoking rates for women and youth in Asian countries where doors were forced open by threat of severe U.S. trade sanctions, that's cigarettes and advertising. The death toll is incalculable. One Oxford University epidemiologist estimated that in China alone, among children under 20 today, 50 million will die of cigarette-related diseases, a substantial number because of highly selective U.S. free trade doctrine. That example illustrates some of the welfare outcomes of the fanatic political theology that elevates trade to the highest rank among human values. Trade should be thought of in quotes because of the elastic and highly ideological construction of that concept. Well, for all harmful substances, it is well known that treatment and prevention are the most effective measures. The most widely cited study is by the RAND Corporation, sponsored by the U.S. Army and the Office of National Drug Control Policy. They found that funds spent on domestic drug treatment were 23 times as effective as what's called source country control, that's Clinton's Colombia plan, 11 times as effective as interdiction, and 7 times as effective as domestic law enforcement. There were efforts to introduce some limited funding for treatment and prevention in the current Colombia plan, also for alternative crop programs that peasants and the Colombian guerrillas have been requesting, but that's all in vain. The inexpensive and effective path will not be followed. Rather, the drug war is crafted to target poor peasants abroad and poor people at home by the use of force, not constructive measures to alleviate the problems that allegedly motivate it at a fraction of the cost. The drug war is described on all sides as a failure, and then the failed methods are pursued more vigorously while effective alternatives are rejected. So a rational person will therefore conclude that the drug war is achieving its actual goals. It's pretty clear what those are. It's providing a pretext to maintain traditional structures of power and free access to markets and resources abroad. And at home, it's a device to control the superfluous population, what are called the desechables in Colombian jargon, the ones you throw away. They're removed to the rapidly expanding prison system. Meanwhile, the rest of the population is frightened, which is not an unimportant task in a period when a domestic form of structural adjustment is being imposed, which is imposing a significant cost on the majority of the population. And one last comment about that. The form of globalization that has been imposed by Western power has been accompanied by a significant deterioration of macroeconomic statistics. Growth rates have slowed considerably worldwide, along with productivity and capital investment. Interest rates have been much higher, which slows growth. Financial markets have been highly volatile. That requires regular public bailout of banks and investors and subjects populations to severe crises. In the United States, wage levels for the majority have stagnated or declined for over 20 years. That's an unprecedented failure of the economy. and the workload has sharply increased to the highest level in the industrial world. Social indicators have declined from their peak in the mid-70s at the onset of globalization back to the level of about 1960. The situation elsewhere is similar, mostly worse, in fact. The World Bank recently reported that Latin America is no better off than it was more than two decades ago, despite far-reaching economic reforms, which raises some obvious questions about the reforms. Financial liberalization, which is a core part of Western instituted globalization, financial liberalization undermines popular sovereignty. It's intended to do that. Socioeconomic policy falls into the hands of what is sometimes called a virtual parliament of investors and lenders who have veto power over policy. They can block irrational policies that merely help people, not profit, simply by sending capital out of the country. That's one of the reasons why the post-World War II Bretton Woods system, which has been dismantled since the 1970s, one of the reasons why it was founded on capital controls and relatively fixed exchange rates. Many economists have described the pre-neoliberal period as a golden age that has been supplanted by a leaden age. It is, however, a golden age for a few, for the owners, the managers, the investors, and the authors of the fairy tales about fairy tale economies. But it should hardly be a great surprise that one hears different voices in the streets and the villages throughout the world and outside these doors as well.